So I remember when one of my first trips to Israel, I was a little kid, 17, something like that, and one of the highlights of the trip, actually, was we were staying by my grandparents' apartment, actually pretty close to here, on Jabotinsky, and right next to their apartment was a little makhola. So yeah, I thought this was so cool, my little makhola there, running down the street, pick up cereals, whatever. One thing which really shocked me, though, as a 7 or 8-year-old kid, was we also bought bread at that makhola. And living in America, this is something that you like obviously never did. You didn't just go to the grocery store and buy fresh bread from the non normal grocery. That wasn't a thing. We didn't live in the 5 towns in Chicago. We didn't have one of those kosher, everything kosher or whatever. So you didn't just buy fresh bread from the neighborhood grocery store. How could we do that? I was like, what's going on? There's a guy behind the counter. He's kind of wearing a kippah. Like, well, what is this? And my parents explained to me that we are in Israel. And the Israeli people here are kosher, and this thing, everything's very different. The bread is being supplied by kosher bakers, and everything is obviously totally fine. I thought that was fantastic. I thought that was very, very cool. So what exactly is the deal with food cooked by non-Jews? There's a whole subsection of halacha, a few different yisurim, which are, they're all gzeiros d'rabbanan, none of them are actually yisurim d'oraisa, they're all d'rabbanan, it's important to note, that there are different things where chazal would go there on food which was made or cooked by non-Jews. So that's hot akum, bread which is made by non-Jews, the bishul akum, we're going to be discussing today, food which has been cooked or prepared, cooked by non-Jews. There's also cholov akum, milk which was milked by non-Jews, and then Venus akum. This is what they're supposed to talk about there. So those are the four main ones. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah discusses each of these really the second paragraph, the Mishnah on Lamed Hay, and each one kind of has their own quirks. Pasach and Bishalach are going to be the two which are most similar to each other, obviously, but even then, there are big differences between the two areas of halacha. We're going to be dealing mainly with Bishalach because I think it comes up a little bit more often than Pasach. There's a big heter for Pasach, we'll probably get into it if we decide to go into it, but the big heter by Pasach is that something called Paspalter. Bakery bread, if you don't have another option, is technically mutter. Better to avoid, but it is technically mutter. That seems to be coming out of recognition of how important bread is. Just in a daily diet, everybody eats bread. Some people eat bread with every meal. In YU, Tversky, based on a thing in breakfast, Tversky said that it used to be every bite, basically, was taken with bread. You would like have the bread in one hand, fork in another hand, and each bite would be basically bread and whatever you're eating together. It fills you up, maybe it means you're not spending as much on the actual food. So, as a recognition of how important bread is, it's just sometimes you don't have kosher bakers, you don't have people who are baking bread, and you need people some time to make bread every single day, so that's why they were matzah paspalter, but it does definitely increase the hazard and availability, or the option of non-kosher bread, non-Jewish cooked bread. Obviously, you can't have non-kosher bread, but bread which is cooked by a non-Jew. Bishalach does not have that hazard, and therefore it's much more, there's a lot more to be aware of.
Even though you're not going into the pasach, what do you mean? The problem though, which is, they want to use unsifted flour. They wouldn't care about the sifted flour. Wouldn't that be the main problem?
No.
You can actually go buy them on Arabs here or their bread.
So that's presumably not actually the main reason. We're going to get into the reasons for bishalach, and when we discuss pasach, if we discuss pasach, then we'll get into the reasons for that also, but that actually doesn't seem to be the main concern in most of these different gezeiros. So there's stuff about drinking alcohol together with non-Jews, a lot of like gezeiros or gezeiros split up. So let's get into the reason. What exactly would be the reason Chazal made this gezeiro? What were they looking to accomplish? So one obvious one, yes, they've already alluded to, what might the concern be? We're talking about sifted flour, but who knows what's in the ingredients. That's a big hack by vegan restaurants. Maybe vegan restaurants should need hashirim because they're not using any sort of organic ingredients, or they're not using any animal ingredients because they're vegan. So what should be the problem? The first and biggest, most concerning response is all the bugs, all the vegetables that they're going to be using, they're not checking, and therefore that's a huge problem. Definitely not the only problem, but that's one of the problems that they have to deal with. So maybe that's the concern with bishalach, with pasach, with a bunch of these gezeiras, by cholavach also, non-kosher animals, milk of non-kosher animals is going to be non-kosher. There's a very strong concern that they're going to be being betrayed. could be unknowingly, could be they just don't care. Bishop often you have no idea what they're putting in, whatever it is that they're serving you. They're serving you a nice, a nice chili. It smells delicious. But like, who knows what they put in there? If they could have cheese in there, if they have, what else is not kosher? Bugs in there, milk and meat in there.
What? I think that's not
possible. Oh, see, we're going to give the Hagdara, but this is all about cooking. So you have no idea what they're putting in. That's one potential concern. The other concern, this really seems to be the main motivation, is let's say that you're able to just share meals freely with the non-Jews. They can invite you over to their house, invite you over for Friday night dinner, they invite you over for Sunday lunch, and Thanksgiving is by them, and Christmas is by them, Thanksgiving is by you. And you can just freely share meals back and forth. You develop this wonderful relationship. What's the, I guess, potentially obvious concern? Something that we call chasmus, or chasmut. Is that the concern is when you develop such close relationships with your non-Jewish neighbors, especially shared over meals, people get to relax with each other, people are reciprocating, I host you, you host me, families are getting to know each other, there's a very strong concern of hizbulut, or intermarriage. That's something we obviously want to present, we want to prevent very strongly. There's a speaker, I think 2 years ago in America, who made waves, obviously reformed, not in any way, shape, or form orthodox, a reformed speaker at some graduation who presented the idea that our insistence against intermarriage is a form of racism, and it's disgusting, and we should be free to share our genes and our chosen status with the rest of the world by intermarrying. Obviously, that's not what we're going for. That's not our direct, let's say. So we definitely want to prevent process. We're looking to avoid deep, meaningful relationships with non-Jews. Interesting sugya as to what kind of relationships are appropriate to develop with our non-Jewish neighbors. A lot of different areas we'll have to look at to figure out what values, what perspective we should be having on that. Obviously, we're not going to do that now, but you can definitely understand, no matter what the perspective is Halakha wants us to have on a non-Jewish neighbors, it should not be getting to a point where intermarriage is a possibility. So we have two potential reasons for the Gzera. To prevent chasmus, and there's also the concern, he's going to see you trade. A very strong naskamina, and this is brought up in the first Pitzke Shua on the Sugya of the Siman Shulchan Aruch. We're at the Siman Kufya Gimel. We've been jumping around a little bit. This is a big jump. Kufya Gimel is all about Bishul Akum. Kufya Beis is about Tas Akum. This is the area where we're discussing these types of things. So the naskamina is, what about a non-from Jew? It's pretty cool. This can happen anywhere, but it's a lot more likely. It could happen here in Israel. So a lot more people who are, let's say, traditional or whatever it is, and they're working in the restaurant serving you food. So would this issue of Bishul Akum apply because the guy behind the counter is a non-Jew? So we have our two reasons. There's a concern he's going to feed you trade. There's a concern that the concern of intermarriage. So not behind the counter. Let's assume in houses. We can talk about counters and restaurants. We're going to get there soon. But right now, let's assume you might be over to share a meal together. So if the concern is chasmus, what would you say? This doesn't apply to a non-Jew. No problem. He's Jewish. His daughter's Jewish. Assuming he married Jewish, and that's definitely the assumption. So no problem of chasmus. It would be totally fine to go over to his house. You do still need to, I talked to him about kashrus. The things he's serving you do still need to be kosher. But there's no inherent problem with the food that he's cooking for you, midin bishul ki'ilu, or in quotes, bishul akum. But what if the concern is that he's going to feed you straight? If this guy is not masken on halacha, that concern definitely still does exist. So if you're not going to be involved in the cooking process, which we're going to talk about soon, if the reason for the gzeira was there's a concern he's going to feed you straight, then it would apply as much to a non-from Jew, let's say to a mumar, maybe a better way to say it. Someone who's not just not from, but has rejected halacha, has rejected the bindingness of halacha. So there's a significant concern. He's going to feed you trade. So the din would still apply. So really, how do we concern how he passed from there? Meikar adin. Seems like the postman debated this for a long time. Seems like Meikar adin, the postman was not here. The main issue being chasnos. However, the Mahadrin hashkafos are ma'amir on this, in that they generally have the firm hashkiach like him. So that's something which is a relevant question here in Israel, really all over the place, but a lot more here in Israel. We're going to extend this to restaurants a little bit pretty soon. So why do we even have two reasons? Wouldn't one reason have been enough? So both reasons come from Rashi's different places in the Sakhta. Most people say, oh, Rashi changed his mind. He had one idea over here, he had another idea over there, and that's why we have two different reasons from Rashi. Obviously, if that's how like Ian worked, if that's how analysis worked, then we would, I don't know, everybody would be out of a job. There would be no such thing as Ian. There's no depth there. We can try to take it a little bit deeper. The Rav has this case as an example of something that he actually discusses often. Rav Shesher likes to talk about this in the Rav a lot. There's this idea of Kol Kachin Rabbanan Kein Do Raisa Tikkun. That any rule that Chazal made, a Chazal were empowered to make Gedarim, to make Gezeros, to institute certain things which were not Midah Raisa. It's important to recognize them not Midah Raisa, that they're on a different level. But at the same time, they're obviously binding. However, part of the directions that they were given when making these takanos is that they're meant to model them or pattern them after Dine Deo Raisa. Kol Tatakon Rabbanan, which is any takana made by a Chazal, is meant to be Ke'en Deo Raisa Tikkun. It's meant to be modeled after a Din Deo Raisa. They have to find something to pin their on. Shafi like, talks about this with Muksa by Shabbos. Muksa, most parts of Muksa have been Deo Rabbanan, but they patterned it after, I think he says, Toma Vitara by Kalim. In terms of how useful a kli is, they pattern Hilchos Muktzah off of that Din Deo Raisa. So how does that work here? The actual reason Chazal wanted to make the Gzeira was to prevent Tasa. I don't know if it was they saw in their time that people were sharing meals together and it was really bad. Tasa was intermarriage, bold loop was happening, and that was really bad. So they wanted to make the Gzeira, but they didn't have a halakhic category to pin that on. There's no mitzvah there right there where it says don't intermarry, kind of obvious. Discussions, don't know, whatever, but they didn't have anything to directly pin this to. So the Deo Raisa that they connected it to was Suffolk Trefus. Trefus, obviously, there are things we are allowed to eat, there are things we are not allowed to eat. So they connected it. The Rav calls this the Tam Hadin and the Opti Hadin. The Tam Hadin, the reason for making the Gzera was Tasmus, to prevent Tasmus, but the Opti, the nature of the Din, is Suffolk Trefus. And you see that they're different, not for me to based on that idea. One other perspective as to why there are two different reasons, this is a fascinating idea from the Maharan Tadawa, sounds like something in Star Wars, he has a safer record, Mayim Chaim, where he says that neither reason, neither Tzatikrikos, nor the potential Chasnas, would have been strong enough on their own to come up with this behavior. The Oster sharing meals with neighbors, neither reason alone would be strong enough. Once you have the two of them together, then it justifies the Gzeira. This leads beautifully into the two main Heterim for Bishul Akum. Two main Heterim for Bishul Akum is if a food is Eino Ola al Shulchan Malachim, is not chashuv enough to be brought to a king's table, we're going to say if it wouldn't be served at a wedding, basically. If it's not chashuv enough to be served at a wedding, then it doesn't matter who cooks it. Even if a non-Jew cooks it, it's still fine to eat. That's heter number one. Heter number two is a nachal t'moshu chai. If something is edible raw, then even if the guy decides to cook it, it doesn't matter. It's still totally fine. So our two biggest heterim is ola shol in ola shol malachim and nachal t'moshu chai. Why does this fit so nicely with the Maharam Tadawa? Why does this fit so nicely with that idea? Because let's consider each one. Eino ola al shulchan malachim, something which is not chashuv, which is not a chashuv food. Are you going to really feel so close to the guy if he just, I don't know, pops a pop tart into the toaster for you? Let's use that as an example. Something which is eino ola al shulchan malachim. He barely did anything for you. It's not a chashuv food. He poured you like some bread. He put some milk into cereal. He barely did anything to facilitate this meal for you. That's not going to be the part of your diet. That's not going to bring you close to the guy. There's no concern of chashuv to that type of food.
Yes. If he feels so comfortable serving you, or he's lazy.
I hear this part. So that's the one side. So the one big heter is directly connected to that idea. Eino ola shulchan malachim is because it's not going to lead. Could be because it's not going to lead to chasna. Then you walk over to the other side. The nechal kemoshu chayim. Picture things which are edible and raw. What are things that are coming from vegetables? Fruit, things which generally, obviously we have bug problems, the things which are generally don't have in other ingredients mixed in, what?
Not a meal in and of itself.
It's not a meal in and of itself. Another way to say it, it's things which you can be pretty confident in terms of like what ingredients are going to be in there. You know, each ingredient that's in the dish you're going to have to consider, we're going to talk about it when we get to that header, but if you could see how Nechal Kemoshu Chayim would be connected to the lack of hashash of trefos, and therefore, again, you're totally fine from that second reason. So if the Maharam Tadawa is correct, and we're taking these two reasons and kind of fusing them within the Gzeira of Bishul Akum, that both reasons were necessary for Chazal to come up with this Gzeira, then it fits very nicely that the two Heterim link up to each side. Something also important to mention, we've spoken about before, but in terms of our assumptions about past, shouldn't we just say that everything should be us or out of hand, because this guy is probably at some point in his life cooked, I don't know, he's had a bacon sandwich, he's had pepperoni pizza, and he's used his past for tracos in the past. Why doesn't that automatically trace off whatever food he cooks? It should be automatic. So our general assumption, unless we know otherwise, is that pots, whether it's Jewish pots or non-Jewish pots, are always going to be in the yom, in under the yom. Meaning the last time they were used was more than 24 hours ago. We mentioned the sheets in the past, that even if it's just, a night in the past, not even a full 24 hours, in certain cases, definitely not in any sort of the hafila, even the yevet, but with other seirfim, we wouldn't be comfortable relying on that. But in general, we're able to assume that 24 hours has passed since the last time this pot has been used, and therefore, it doesn't have the taste which is absorbed has become tam, pagum, and therefore not actually able to transfer any sort of iser to the food anymore.
Even
trace juice. Right? We said there's a difference between not far not and enem b'neyom, right? Tam, pagum. Not far not. By heter foods, we've always said there's a little bit a little bit of the kosher taste still there, it's not significant enough to mix with anything else, but if you have trace not far not, then a small amount of trace is still trace. That would be a problem. But by tam pagum, by negative taste, it doesn't really matter what the source of the taste was, what the pagum was. Pagum was taste bad. We don't really care about it anymore, whether the source was kosher or trade. But that was the two potential reasons for the gzeira and how they interact with each other. The Rashi maybe changed his mind, the Rav's important idea of tam and opi for gzeira, and then the Maharam Hadawa, maybe both reasons were necessary to make this gzeira strong enough, and then once, if you don't have one of them, then if one of them, yeah, once one of them doesn't apply, either because in or also from Lachim, or Nefo Kamoshu Chai, then the gzeira will no longer be a problem. There are shikos in the Rishonim which think that, let's say you need both of the reasons before you have a heter, that something needs to be both not kosher enough to be brought to the king's table, and also Nefo Kamoshu Chai, we do not pass in that way, we take both reasons of kula, meaning whether you have one or you have the other one, you're already okay. So we're going to look into both of the heter reasons. Heter number one, Eino Ol Al Shulchan Lachem. So obviously we've never really been invited to a king's table, although there are 47 kings and princes and ministers and presidents currently in the country. For the big Holocaust memorial, 75 years since Auschwitz, let's close all the streets and make things incredibly convenient for everybody who's in yeshiva right now. They pushed me around from Shai Yafa to Shai Tzion, and it seems like it technically is not supposed to be able to go through Shai Tzion. But anyway, so we have about
and the other room closed out.
It's empty. I don't know if it's officially closed, but they didn't let me bike up through Shai Yafa, so we closed it off.
So the first step that you said about in work again, do you still have to be involved in the process?
That would help it. If the whole idea is cure dots and you appreciate so much what they've done for you, then once you're involved, it's a lot less. Like, I cooked my own meal, you didn't do much for me, I'm not doing it for both of you.
But if we just use the person there that you can just eat that no visual option because,
the first answer is it's not.
But you're not going to get close enough to them, don't you still have to worry about conscience?
Yeah, the content of the actual ingredients is still a concern. You do need to be aware of what he's using. Even if all the ingredients you know are kosher, if the concern was trace, then we're assuming that it's just let's just go back. The gzeira that's made is made. Even if you go through his pantry and all the ingredients he has there are kosher, it doesn't really matter. The gzeira is made as a gzeira, and anything that he cooks without your involvement following these rules is going to be a problem. Once you've identified what the time for the gzeira is, there are specific ways to get around it. Just because this is the same way like by Mukta, right? One of the reasons for Mukta is that one of the reasons for Mukta is if I'm playing, let's say, with a hammer, I may come to use a hammer to build it. So if I just like say, I don't have any nails around, and I don't have any like houses around, I'm not going to build anything with this hammer, obviously it doesn't matter, the hammer remains Mukta. So one thing there was made, even when we understand the time, that we can't be so quick to just be mivat of it because the thing is not going to be shy. But at the same time, when Chazal built the Netayr, we can take advantage of those there. Alright, so our two reasons are either Chashash Trey or the Chashash Chastas. Knowing what the book focus on can help us understand what did Chazal build in as the theory for these Gezeros. But it's not that we can just decide, I'm not going to get close to him, and therefore Chastas doesn't apply, or I already checked his pantry, he doesn't have any Trey ingredients, and therefore Bishalachim, the Trey's concern doesn't apply. Once the Gezeros is made, the Gezeros is made. So Hetzer number one, Hussein Ola Shulchan Malachim, if the food is not chashav enough to be brought to that king's table, you could also understand, if it's not chashav enough to be brought to that king's table, so what exactly does that mean? I have not been invited to Buckingham Palace, I have not been invited to the White House, not to R.J. Leibowitz, who spoke about his Hanukkah party in the East Wing over Hanukkah, that's pretty cool. So I have not been there, so what do they serve exactly at Shulchan Malachim? How am I supposed to know? So apparently our best analog, our best comparison, is you can judge based on a wedding. What would be chashav enough to be served at a wedding, at a fancy meal, really fancy meal, and what would presumably be left off because it's just not chashav enough. So Rav Bednarsh gave the following list of examples. He said, number one, breakfast cereals. You can imagine your what are they called? The square ones with the chocolate inside?
Karyot,
right? Karyot are good, but I wouldn't call them chashav. They would not make it to a wedding. Kix, haven't had kix since I was 7, but like, hey, those are delicious. But also, probably not going to make it to Shulchan Malachim. I'm not making a Trump joke, but I think if we just, we can't really look at President Trump as an example of these types of things. Even for President Obama. I think he was also pretty much a game changer in terms of how he treated the presidency. Was it a hush of thing, just like he ate whatever he wanted? I think like there's some story he ordered either he had a pizza at some meal or hot dogs and hamburgers at some like state presidential meal. I think that was President Obama. Now again, not knocking the guy, it's just how chashiva is no longer a thing in this world anymore. You have to go back a few generations, back to the time was it Kennedy or? Kennedy took off the hat. Maybe it was Kennedy who took the hat off. So since then, the world has been in a downward spiral in terms of like chashivas for a position and respect for what royalty could theoretically be. So maybe we can't necessarily use it now as our example of what proper conduct would be. But just imagine a chashav meal, you're probably not going to be serving karyot or kix, anything like that. Rav Melamed in the new Kashrut space, Dunya Halacha, this is not nearly as controversial as the other one, he thinks that cereals are Ola al Shulchan Malachim, because like, end of the day, kids are people too, and everybody needs breakfast, so what do you want them to eat? I don't know. Yeah, so they're presumably eating the same karyot that we're eating. So cereals, according to Rav Melamed, would be Ola al Shulchan Malachim, and therefore you do have a Bishalachim conversation. Yeah, push it not. The next thing on Rav Bennarsh's list, snacks and candies. They're probably not eating Twizzlers at weddings. They're probably not eating potato chips at weddings. Those are examples where Bishalachim would not apply. Low quality foods. So a huge machlokas, I think over a bunch of years, has been a question about tuna fish. Is tuna fish something which would be brought to a king's table or not? So part of it does depend on, like, if you have a tuna steak would be served. But tuna fish ground up in the can is a very different thing. Maybe that would not be served on a king's table. How do you deal with that? So the standard is that tuna fish does not need fish in Israel, which is really good. Because the way they process tuna fish is you get this huge boat, goes down the middle of the ocean, they somehow fish for only tunas, which is not possible. So you generally have a mashgiach on a boat to be able to keep an eye on exactly what they get. I think dolphin is actually a big question there. People don't like the tuna boats because sometimes they get dolphins, and you got to save the dolphins, save the whales, save all the fish. Yeah. So they generally have like the OU, I think, has mashgiach on all these boats, so they're keeping an eye on exactly what is caught, and then they're ground up on the boat, and they're canned on the boat. And so if they smoke them, however they have them preserved, so that they don't get disgusting, and then they can, that's all done on the boat. It's like a one-stop shop factory, it's pretty cool. So it's helpful that you don't need fish oil yourself, because like how many Jews are hanging on those boats to be involved in the cooking process, for some not too many. But we should all have a lot of our precious hope from these mashgiachim who do go out to the crazy places, stories about people like flying out to India, and then nobody understanding each other, language issues, crazy things that they're doing to get us exactly those products that we all seem to need, because we can't even know why we need them. The last thing he said is, don't be too quick to assume something is not Ola al Shulchan Malachim. It's a little bit of a trend to be pretty makeable in how we define, oh yeah, this is not fascism, that's not fascism, no king would eat this, no king would eat that, and really expand the borders of what is and is not Olah Shel Malachim. Rabbi Nachman just tried to caution us, don't be too quick to assume something is not Olah Shel Malachim. Better to err on the side of caution and say, it could be that we're making on, and if we don't know, you should be not. It's a little bit funny, usually by Derabanan, by Xeros, we say stuff like Derabanan and Bula. I think we've been our children saying that we're not using that cloud here, it's just that we have heard from people that they're just being way too makeable, that even past what would otherwise be. So if you're about to lock it, so you have to roll it back a little bit. Another question is, do you go based on the specific food or the dish? This is relevant to the tuna fish question, to the steak versus the tuna in the can. Do you go based on the food or the dish, the way it's prepared? So the Shulchan Aruch discusses rice bread. And this is something which is important for gluten-free people who are intolerant of gluten. They would have other forms of bread. One type is bread made out of rice. So rice is a food. It's obviously Olah Shel Malachim. Rice is a staple, no matter if you live in the White House or you're a stam guy in a hut. Everybody has rice, especially at this party. So that would be usher. But rice bread is very low quality, right? Rice bread is very low quality bread. It's not even one of the five grains. So that would not be Olah Shel Malachim. No king is going to be having rice bread unless you have a specific issue, and that's not going to define anything. So the psak for rice bread is mustard, even though rice itself is Olah Shel Malachim. We say that rice bread is fine, meaning bishlachim does not apply to it. You can have a non-Jewish baker bake you some rice bread. That shows you go by the dish as opposed to the food itself. It's not the species, it's the way it's prepared.
But that exact way is in the Aruch Shulchan, it's not in the Gemara. The rice is right. Where is it from?
Shulchan.
Oh, it's from Shulchan.
If the dish itself, another detail, if the dish itself is something which is usually served with some sort of a garnish, pasta is a good example, right? Nobody's serving pasta plain. We serve pasta plain to my 2-year-old, who likes it. But nobody that had a fancy meal is serving pasta plain. There's something on it. You got sauce, you have roasted tomatoes, penne, aglio olio. There are a lot of different ways you can do pasta, but no one's actually just doing plain pasta. So you could potentially argue that pasta alone should be no bishlachim, and once you've added stuff, once you put stuff on it, once you garnish it, then you have bishlachim problems. We do not pass in that way. We say that as long as the base, would be served with other things on shulchan malachim, then the base alone, even without the garnish, still qualifies and would be usher within bishlachim. Okay.
If the base itself,
yeah, then we already consider the base as Olah Shel Malachim and Mr. Bishlachim would apply. It also makes sense. Often the way you make these foods is you would cook them separately. You would cook the pasta, you would cook the other things, you mix them all together into one dish. That's how it's being served. So it would make sense that it gets extended to the pasta. Okay, heter number 2. Nefel Kemoshu Chai. Many products are made from ingredients which are Nefel Kemoshu Chai. A lot of things which are made from the raw ingredients which would have been edible as they were. Applesauce, great example, right? Applesauce is basically just apples with a little bit of sugar, maybe some water, maybe a little bit of oil. The main ingredients are things which I would be comfortable, I'd be happy to eat raw. And therefore, there's no bishlachim even for that finished product. Butter, almonds, cheese, beet, carrots, corn, all these things, most soups, basically, are generally going to be Nefel Kemoshu Chai. So therefore, all those, it doesn't really matter who's making it, even if a non-Jew is making or cooking that food, since the raw ingredients would have been edible, therefore the finished product is mutter also.
An example of soup, some of the alphabetic is like beans. If most of the soup is vegetable, you know, just one, like, I say, not a bean, where did I have?
Yeah, sure.
Then does that make the whole
odd soup
not good?
It's going to be similar to Hilchos Brachos discussion. So by Hilchos Brachos, sometimes we talk about the ikker, and the bracha is determined by the ikker. Sometimes we have their different parts, and you make separate brachos on each part. So like, Shulchan Aruch talks about a panada, which is like a meat pie. So the meat obviously needs to be cooked. The bread has, or the, I think by bread we had one that came from Pas Akum, the Pas Halter. What does it have to say by bread? Okay, that was a bad example. Yeah, that was a bad example. Chicken soup, which is a much better example. So by chicken soup, let's say the carrots, right? Carrots are natural commercial in kind, high, but the chicken, we assume, is not going to be edible. There's a whole movement now. Raw foods, you know about this stuff? Obviously sushi, you know about sushi. Raw fish, but there's also raw meat, which is called carpaccio. It's like very thinly sliced raw meat, and you're supposed to enjoy it if you're a cultured person. Yeah. Does that change the status of fish lakum? Do we now say that meat or steak is natural kosher in Thai because of police carpaccio? It's not just like weird guys, it's like in restaurants.
No, but anyway, I think that it
definitely is very different, and I think at least for now we're still saying that those guys are weird. Maybe it's like a bubble. I don't know if Milana mentioned it, he didn't use this line, but maybe you could apply bubble dito. Yeah, that just because a few weird people are doing something, because I guess the trend is cool, that is not going to determine the stock for the grill, it's not going to determine the stock for everybody. But I don't think anybody's eating raw chicken. I have not heard of that one. So let's say you have a chicken soup. The carrots are fine. The chicken's going to be a problem, though, because the chicken is not in that whole motion of high. So the chicken offers the carrots. Right, the chicken being cooked in the same dish together with the carrots is ashes and the carrots themselves. So it's going to be a discussion with you at the very end of the simon. There's a discussion about the kashas of the pot that you use. Let's say that a guy uses your pot, cooks in his house, and cooks you up a chicken soup. Just to use that example. We just found out that the chicken is going to be ashes and that ashes the rest of the soup. But does that mean that now your pots are ashes? Is it a trickless question, or is it just, he did something wrong, there's a gzera on the food, but the gzera doesn't affect the pot. So we'll get there at the very end. We're going to have 2 weeks on Mishalakim, so we'll get back to that question at the very end of the sentence. So the same way by brachos, we have some things are mixed ingredients, and they're usually still by the ikker. Other things are things where you have to make multiple brachos, and each one is kind of considered individually, so we have the same discussion here. So let's say like carrot muffins. What bracha do you make on normally made carrot muffins? Mezonos, why? It's three parts carrot and only one part flour. Doesn't really matter. Since the flour is considered the ikker of the mezonos, yeah, the flour is going to be considered the ikker of that food, so that would be mainly seen as flour. Once it's mainly seen as flour, it's an edible raw. Right, no one's eating raw flour. So those carrot muffins, even though so much of it is carrot, which is edible raw, we see it definitely from the brachos perspective. We see it as mainly flour, and therefore, if ano natural commercial high, it would be a visual acid problem. The first Gilead Marsha in the Shulchan Aruch talks about black coffee in a coffee house. Apparently, coffee bean is natural commercial high. You could just chew on it and suck on it. I don't know what you would do with a coffee bean. No, it's just ground up. You haven't actually cooked the coffee, so I guess that would be why. So black coffee, obviously, when you start adding things, you're going to get into other problems. But black coffee in a coffee house, cooked by 9 years, would be okay. But they're even cooked mahadra, he says. And then the second Gilead Marsha is a very interesting point. What do you say about something like ginger or onion? Right, side
to side. Yeah,
Avram, my son Avram, knows that if you cut onions, you're going to start crying, boom boom in the eyes, you're just so what would you say about onions, what would you say about ginger? So on the one hand, you definitely know nobody would eat a raw whole onion, but at the same time, if you've had a salad recently, if you've had a tuna fish sandwich, not tuna fish sandwich, if you had a cream cheese sandwich recently, lox and bagels, you had a raw onion, just small slices of them, as opposed to the entire thing. So that would qualify for natural commercial high, and therefore roasted onions or something, fried onions, things like that, would be mutter even if they're fried by a non-Jew. They would not qualify for the usher through Bishul Akum. That's the second billion marsha. It's a great heather. You can see the two sides, comes out of
mutter. Just to make it that
way. You? Okay, a possible third exception, which we generally reject, unless you have other seasons, is that the gzeira does not apply in a Jewish house. If he comes over to your house and wants to cook for you in your house, which is actually a big thing now, you have chefs, it's a service you offer, that you can have a chef come to your house and cook you like this fancy gourmet meal, which is pretty cool. And he's using all your kalim, he's using all your ingredients, what could the problem be? So this Svara said, on the one hand, chasvus doesn't apply, he's cooking in your house, you're the Baal HaBayis, and there's no kiruv dasa, there's no chasvus. Also, it's your house, there no, you don't have kiruv ingredients in your house, he's only using your stuff, so there's no chashash reifus. Maybe, since neither reason applies, we should there not be applied, we say no. Generally rejected. This is the Shita of Rabbeinu Avraham, brought in Tosfos. Tosfos says we're not going to go for that one. It's going to come up again soon, it's going to come up again later with other sneezes, but on its own, we don't accept that. A possible fourth exception, also rejected by halacha, is the idea of tashil halter. Tashil halter, meaning food which was cooked in an establishment as opposed to a private home. Something cooked in a restaurant, maybe, again, neither reason applies. Really the tashilus issue.
What's
the difference
between
Pachpat and Pachpat? Oh, beautiful, very good. That's the main question. The source of the potential heter is if we have Pachpat, why don't we have Tashpat? It should be the same thing. The rejection should be, I'm pretty sure, rather than have to double check, but I'm pretty sure the rejection is Pachpat is a very special heter based on the status of bread as a mainstay of the meal. You can really, definitely back then, you couldn't really have a meal without having bread. Also, that's why bread has a bracha l'atzmo. Bread is such a kosher, it has such a kosher status throughout all of the halacha because it was the mainstay of every meal, that's what it was. So it's just not really possible to say, oh, you live in a small town, and therefore you just can't have bread for the rest of your life. Like, so they were not interested in doing that, so they made heter pachpater. Again, you can't eat trace because it's difficult, but if you know what the ingredients are, bread is also pretty simple. It's just flour and water, maybe a little bit of yeast. Assuming you know what the ingredients are, one, and also it's being cooked in public as opposed to you going over to your friend's house to another Baal HaBayis and getting bread from him. So you don't have the kiruv das, you don't have the same concerns with cosmos, so they made a special heter for bread. But they're not going to extend that to tachilim. They're not going to extend that to things you just want to go out and have a nice time. You're going to go to a restaurant. They weren't going to give you that special heter. So they made a special heter for pas. They did not extend it to tachilim. Okay. So one of the big, I guess, the light applications of this whole discussion, I think it's going to be our last point for today, is housekeepers cooking dinner. That's the thing. A little bit more in certain parts of America. I don't know if it's as much a thing here in Israel, but you have a nanny, you have a housekeeper, somebody who basically spends a lot of time in the house to scare the kids, whatever. And it can be incredibly convenient to say, I have some noodles in the closet. Can you just make my kids some noodles and cheese? Throw it in the oven. It'll be ready by the time I get home. They can have an early dinner and then whatever it is. It can be incredibly convenient to have the housekeeper who's home take care of basically some of the cooking for you. Would that be okay? So the fifth dalit in Shulchan Aruch, according to Machlokas, he says there are those who allow shvachos to cook for you. Shvachos, we're assuming, is not necessarily, well, it's going to be part of the discussion. Is shvachos different because you own them, but there's a din of ownership on shvachos, or is it because you told your kiyivu forcing them to do something, and they're not volunteering or choosing to do something on their own free will? That's going to be part of the discussion. But let's assume we have shvachos. There are those who allow them to cook for you, no bishlaka problem, and there are those who say that it's usher. The Rama says, l'chatchila, usher, b'di'evin, mutter, but in the Beis Yisrael, in a Jewish house, it would be mutter. Why is mutter afilu l'chatchila? Why is mutter afilu l'chatchila? Because people walking by, mesama, stoked the coals, meaning they were involved in the cooking, without them. Let's say they were involved in the cooking, and once they were involved in the cooking, Bishalakam Lamassi goes away. That's going to be what we're going to dedicate the next week's shiur to. That's another one, the other thing out there for Bishalakam. Somebody was presumably involved. So, Lumaisa, what do we do with that? Do we accept that? Do we not accept that? Nowadays, I don't know, we usually don't have people walking around just like fiddling with buttons on stoves, so the Ramada's justification doesn't seem to apply. So what do we postulate about this type of a question? So the Maisa Yeshua HaKel did the Eved, if you have two of the four possible occasions, right? There are 4 points made by the different reports in the Shulchan Aruch as to what the Svara was to be made one. So one of them was if you own the shifa, then it's not they're just applying, they're cooking because you're forcing them to. Let's say the ownership point. They're not really seen as goyim, they're seen as your emu property. That obviously does not apply to housekeepers. You don't own them, you're paying them. You hire them, you definitely don't own them. Another one of the possible heterim was I think also rejected. Was the second one that was rejected? There it is. B'nai Abaye is supposed to be calling that the people who are in the house are messing with the coals. That's generally not done nowadays either. You usually don't fiddle with the knobs and move the pot around. People who are cooking, the rest of the people in the house are not getting involved. So neither of those two svaros do apply. The other two are relevant though. So as long as you have the other two, you'd be okay. Number one, the Rabbeinu Avraham that we mentioned, that anything the basic girl, any non-Jew cooking in a Jewish house, automatically there is not going to apply. Because they're not comfortable relying on that one alone, but this is an example where you can use it as a basic blocker. So that would be number one. Number two, the Rashba says the chasmus, the idea of chasmus, the concern of chasmus does not apply if she's cooking for you because she has to. If you're employing her and she's not volunteering to do this, this is not her saying, I want to do you a favor, I want to have you over for a meal, anything like that. You're paying her to do something. She's cooking for you kind of because she has to. There's no free will involved. There's no free choice. That gzeira of chasmus is not going to apply. So as long as you have both of those two reasons, it's the basic shell, and she's cooking as a hired worker as opposed to somebody who's just volunteering to do you a favor, which is something which could happen also if she's feeling particularly generous and she wants to cook food for the family, and you don't have that rashba, you don't have that heter, and then you wouldn't have this gula. But the Rama says, as long as you have those two sides, if you have those two svaros, then you can be nako, definitely to the Eved, when your housekeeper cooks you food. Not something you should rely on the chachila, lamaisa, but if it does happen, let's say you're at home, your parents aren't so often, and your parents have the housekeeper cooking food, you want to know, do I need to make it? Do I have to go with the peanut butter and jelly and sandwich, or can I just have whatever she made? And it does depend a little bit on how tough it is, but the makom torah, end of the day, which is always hard to define, but the makom torah, you would be allowed to eat for the housekeeper's cooking.
That's
for sure going to be wrong. That doesn't go anywhere. Okay, so we had our two big criteria. We're Ein Olah Sof Malachim, number one. Nefil Moshu Chai, number two. And a possible heter of Shvachos, of somewhere where it's a non-Jew cooking, where there's, let's say, a less than equal relationship between you and the person cooking. Potentially that could be a heter also. The other big heter, this is where all the Sephardi Ashkenazi Machlokim get involved, is the last one, which we're going to talk about next week, is where the Jew is involved in the cooking. Just how much of a heter is that? The Ashkenazim go way, way, way far, and Sephardim are much more resistant in terms of using that one, and that leads to much more expensive restaurants for Sephardim. All right, next week.